Put your window down!
He wants something.
He's probably drunk.
You're going the wrong way!
What?
You're going the wrong way!
He said we're going the wrong way!
Oh, he's drunk! How would he know where we're going?
Yeah, how would he know? Thank you. Thanks a lot. Terrific.
Thank you!
What a moron.
You're going in the wrong direction! You're going to kill somebody! You're going the wrong way!
What the fuck?
Iowa football going the wrong way?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess the thought process has to be, you know, we were 4-2 at this point last season as well and went on a horrendous 6-game losing streak. So the question is, you know, did the performance this past Saturday seem so bad that that seems like a high likelihood to you?
Unknown. And I think that's what's got everybody on edge, because it wasn't the loss, right? If you had said we were going to lose to Michigan State, people are like, well, you know, it's a tough rivalry. They're a good school. You lose to Michigan State, but it was the way they looked, and it was the regression back to a lot of old habits. I think they looked a lot more like the team we saw last year than the team we've seen the last 4 weeks.
See, here's the weird thing for me, though.
We do need to say, welcome to the 12 Saturdays podcast. I'm James Blato.
And I'm Tori Breck.
And we're recovering from, or not recovering, we're
here's the weird
regrouping.
Thing. Here's the weird thing to me. I was kind of in the whole planes, trains, and automobiles thing myself while this game went on. I was trying to get back from Philadelphia. So I actually didn't even see the best part of the game. Both Iowa touchdowns.
The 5 minutes and 27
right.
seconds where
both
they actually
Iowa
looked
touchdowns
competent
happened during the very short flight from O'Hare to Moline. So I'm sitting at the bar in O'Hare. I saw most of the first quarter, and it was, you know, ugly slugfest. Neither team seemed like they could do anything. They missed a field goal. Iowa couldn't do much. And then they were down, I think, 3-0 when I got on the plane. And I fly over and I'm messing around and I'm getting my luggage and I go into the bar because I wanted to see some of the game and in the quad season. I'm like, oh my God, we're up 14-10. This isn't so bad. Wow, this is crazy. And then they gave up a long pass play. And then I went and got my luggage and I drove. Then I had to listen to Gary Dolphin, who I swear to God thinks everybody's watching TV along with him because he doesn't tell you what's actually happening anymore. And so what I'm getting at, long story short, I didn't even get to see the good part, and I guess I didn't view it as badly as so many other people seem to have.
I think watching it play out, play by play, drive by drive, first of all, so many 3-and-outs. We didn't get our first down until that first scoring drive with 5 minutes left to go in the first half. So not even being able to get a first down for almost two quarters of football is a little unnerving. Watching players get injured that we, and I think Blackheart Goldpants was the one that said it best when they're like, at one point we had Scherf, Weissman, Kevante Martin-Manley, Kirksey, and Dominic Alves all injured. in a team that is built to operate with exactly zero of those people on the bench.
And we talked about that earlier in the season about how this team seemed like it was okay with the starters, but there was going to be little margin for error.
And
for
it seems
injuries.
Like that we're going to, you know, the bye week is coming, you know, but injuries were minor and the bye week's coming in an opportune time. But still, this is the situation right when you were boarding your plane to Moline is we're down 10 to nothing. But we haven't
3
even...
3-0 when I boarded,
thought. Well, it's 10-0, you know, late in the second quarter. Michigan State gets the ball back at halftime. And we have something like 20 yards of offense.
Right.
Now, the defense did okay. And statistically and, you know, a lot of those field goals they had by rights should have been touchdowns. It should have been a blowout. That's where I think a lot of the folks who watched it play out are like, wow, we really dodged a bullet. They missed a field goal that kicked, I think, four or five field goals.
You know, and I didn't have the heart to actually sit down and watch it from beginning to end.
But three of those
end,
five
so.
Field goals should have been touchdowns.
Okay.
So the margin of error, it was much more of a beatdown than I think the scoreboard would indicate because it was only 5 minutes and 27 seconds where Iowa actually looked like they belonged on that field.
But I'll tell you what I did see, though, and I wrote about this a little bit in my column this week, is this, and it's natural, it's human nature, and I do it too, but that propensity to focus solely on what your favorite team isn't doing and their shortcomings. And when I was watching that game, and, you know, have you ever been in that position where you're, like, out of your normal environment, not with your normal people, so you almost view it in a more objective eye?
Yep.
So I'm sitting here with this guy that's a Notre Dame fan at the bar at O'Hare. By the way, great Goose Island on tap, and that Frontera has the best tapas. So, and
which is that terminal concourse C?
B in I think it's Terminal One, and they make tapas.
Well, yeah, everything's
the Skip Bayless one. It's freaking awesome. Anyway, so I'm watching it, and
Terminal C has a Goose Island tap.
Yeah, I know. I've been there.
That's
too.
Awesome.
I didn't have time, but anyway. Food. So what I've and I was like, Michigan State came into the game with the number one ranked defense in the country, and they looked it.
Yeah.
They looked it. I mean, they were fast, they were big, they were strong, they were good. And I guess, yeah, I was frustrated by the lack of offense. I thought Ruddock actually showed good poise for the most part. I mean, plays were left out of the field. The pass protection was okay. The run game was a nightmare. But I guess to me, it was more about how awesome Michigan State played defense than how poorly Iowa played offense.
They did, particularly early on when we were trying to establish the run, and it just wasn't happening. But the fact that we saw some regression in the passing game. I saw a number of passes where Jake was throwing to empty parts of the field.
Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful balls to no one is home, you know, in that area. You know, we saw a couple of catchable balls. We saw a couple of drop passes.
I did see a couple drop passes.
You know, it looked like the ghosts of 2012 were kind of rearing up a little bit. The offense couldn't stay on the field. The defense couldn't get off the field.
Mm-hmm.
And the defense, I mean, statistically looked really good. A lot of those field goals, like I said, should have been touchdowns. One of the things that I think, and we came in, I think, what, the 7th or the 9th defense?
Right.
And we looked at probably.
Left the 11th
right.
after this week.
Well, and the key is, we said we had to make Michigan State beat us through the air. And they did.
Right.
That guy came in not able to, he didn't even complete, like, I think, a pass of longer than 8 yards. And he looked all conference.
I don't think he looked all conference in the parts of the game that I watch. And I watch all of the second half. What I will say is what it looked to me also is that it was a coming up against a team that was superior to us and that also had that bye week to prepare. And what was interesting to me is we said what the weaknesses of this Iowa team were this year, right? It was the secondary and it was special teams.
Yeah.
They exploited both of those. And rode their defense. If you'd have told me before, I picked 16-10 as the Iowa victory. I thought between 14 and 20 points would win the game. I think our defense was on the field too much because of how poor the offense was. And I give the credit mostly to Michigan State. So what I'm saying is I still think this team is better than last year.
Oh, yeah.
And I also wrote this.
But I don't know that that helps.
No.
With the schedule playing.
That is true. And what I was, another thing that I guess it wasn't in my column, but I'd mentioned on the Hawkeye Report in a thread about my column that somebody had mentioned, is that I try to compartmentalize how I feel about the team, i.e. the 2013 Iowa Hawkeyes football team and the program. And I'm not feeling great about the team in terms of what they're going to finish with the final record and all of that. But I do feel like the program had bottomed out at the end of last year and is on that sort of slow, giant container ship turning back in the right direction. I think we hit a little bit of a swale or a rogue wave, and where there's going to be a couple more of those because we're not at the talent level that we need to be a top contender in the Big Ten, and we knew that going into the season.
Yeah, the problem is it's going to be very hard at the end of this season to make that same judgment if you're sitting at 5-7 and staying home for the holidays.
Well, I think for the team, I don't necessarily think for the program. I mean, you start to see...
Well, unfortunately, the program is judged by a string of team achievements. And going back to 11, you know, you're only as good as your most three or four most recent years. And I think, you know, there's really not a whole lot to scream about. Definitely 12 is bad. You could make the case that this is a better year and that the program is turning around, but not fast enough. I mean, college football does not have these 3- and 5- and 7-year time windows of patience for, you know, for coaching staffs, for players. The players, first of all, only have three to five-year careers, right?
I think it depends on the program. I mean, you know, Iowa State's coach hasn't posted a winning season yet, and they think he walks on water. Well, so, I mean, granted, I don't want to be comparing Iowa to our little brother.
We don't want to be in
but,
that bucket.
You know, we've also had some higher highs too. So, you know, I don't know. I guess it comes down to a question. And I want to see how the rest of this season plays out. I'm not conceding anything
yet. Well, yeah. Yes, I agree. And I think that we all believe that, you know, there's probably one good game where Iowa should be favored left on the schedule, which is Purdue. So we're really looking for one. Out of Nebraska and Wisconsin and Michigan and Northwestern and Ohio State. By the way, did you watch that Northwestern-Ohio State game?
I did.
You know how... I hate to admit this, but Northwestern is so entertaining to watch.
In a way.
Offensively. I mean, they lost and then... They did very well on defense.
I'll tell you who entertains me on that team is that little Venrick Mark, running back. He is tough as nails, and I would love to have him on the
Well, they had some good play from their receivers. Mm-hmm. They had that two quarterbacks. They had that, I don't even know, isn't Trevor or somebody that actually
Simeon
is a throwing.
And Coulter, right?
Yeah. Well, they had Kane Coulter, but they had this guy, Trevor.
Simeon, I think. Or
Trevor. His first name is Trevor.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Simeon. Or Simeon.
Whatever. He's actually a fairly good passer, and I think they work that two quarterback system well. But I couldn't get over the clash of style. They looked
style
different.
And size.
Size was amazingly different. I mean, it looked like, you know, a bunch of college guys playing against like a really great and fast high school team.
Right.
You know, and I think I tweeted something like the thing that struck me was that the Northwestern defense just piles on these Ohio State running backs and can't bring them down. And these Ohio State guys keep diving, you know, on the defense. They keep diving for the Northwestern ball carriers and whiffing and grabbing armloads of air.
you know what's interesting, though, when you think about it, is I don't know if you saw the thing with the 5 minutes and 13 seconds or whatever about how close they were to being undefeated last year. And so they had, what, I think 3 or 4 losses last year where they had the lead.
Yep.
And then in this game, again, they had the lead in the fourth quarter. So I like to kind of think about what would the Hawkeye Report be saying if you put those results, and that was Kirk Ferentz and the Hawkeyes. I think it's interesting that Fitzgerald gets lauded as this, oh my God, amazing coach, but, you know, his teams can't close out victories.
Right.
I mean, in the
and
bigger
it reminds
games.
Me, they're having, last year was their kind of 2010 year. Remember,
yeah.
We were so close to
exactly.
Being.
Now, and like I told you in 2010, we've had this argument a million times about how that team really competed at a championship level but just couldn't close it out. So
I think, and the reason I bring that up is I was thinking, like, the Ferentz style of football plays closer to what you see from Ohio State than Northwestern, particularly in offense.
I think it's evolving.
But we probably have closer to the talent level of Northwestern than Ohio State in terms of skill positions.
And, right now.
Yeah, so it struck me as interesting because it seems like you would not have expected Northwestern to run the same exact game plan as Ohio State on that field in that game and even stay win, let alone just hang with them. Mm-hmm. They had to run a different style. They had to run a disruptive and unconventional attack to keep them off balance. And I think that's what drove it home for me is that I think Ferentz has built his program on the presumption that we're going to have a different caliber of talent of player than we currently have, and that you have to kind of play with what you've got as opposed to what you think you should have.
Well, I think they're evolving though towards trying to be something different. I mean, they're not the just straight up smash mouth kind of thing. And that's part of the Greg Davis offense, which is still a work in progress and a TBD in terms of its overall success. I think the other thing with Northwestern is that you have a lot of players that have been in that system and doing things that way for a long time. And we're really only a season and a half into our new, offense and defensive schemes. So, will they be ultimately successful? And, we've talked again about getting through those hiccups of attrition. I'm liking a lot of the young guys on this team as well. I'm a little concerned about what's going to happen at linebacker next year. But I'm feeling pretty good about the talent they're starting to amass. I mean,
do you ever read the Malcolm Gladwell books?
No.
Oh, you should really check them out. I'm reading one now, David and Goliath, and it's talking about turning disadvantage into advantage. Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating. It talks about how people are able to overcome things like dyslexia and the loss of a parent and trauma at a young age and things like that. And I couldn't help but think about that so much while watching Northwestern and Ohio State. And the general idea is that if you go at somebody who has all the advantages and you meet them on even terms, you should expect to lose.
Right.
You have to find a way to tilt the playing field. So, the concern which brings us to...
Well, I was going to say one last point on that, though, is that the concern that I have is kind of one that I didn't think I would again, and that's kind of where we are from a strength and conditioning standpoint. Because I thought in the fourth quarter, Iowa looked like they were not the stronger team, and so it makes you wonder. I mean, Coach Doyle has been lauded so much, and I think he's one of Ferentz's favorites of all time, but are we still getting the bang for the buck out of our strength and conditioning program that we used to be able to count on that?
Well, it's a good point. I will say that if you look at time of possession statistics for that game, they were just stupid.
They literally were worn down.
Exactly.
No matter if you were like CrossFit king of the world.
When you have an entire half of football where you're in three and outs or turnovers, I don't really think you really have your defense giving up somewhere around the third quarter because they played a whole game already by the clock. So I don't really concern Matt. I think injuries may have played a role in that as well, particularly on the offensive and defensive line, because we had two defensive linemen and one offensive. And when my brother was asking me, because he took him to the game, when Scherf went out, he's like, well, who's his backup? I said, I don't know, because it's like a series of dominoes. When one lineman goes down, they all move around.
They put Donnell.
Then somebody moves, and it gets very confusing because they're all listed as each other's backups.
Right.
So I guess I'm not concerned about that. There's two things I was concerned about. Well, first of all, can we just get something out of the way here? And I know it didn't make a difference, but I was pretty pissed off about the officiating. And I know
I didn't get to see any of that because I was watching it without sound, so I didn't know exactly
particularly in a couple of drives where it was long, third and long, Michigan State, and they would convert. And they converted on one where, the defender had, the quarterback, Cook, just dead to rights, and this wide receiver comes up and just shoves him in the back, and no flag. And then there was just this chintzy little makeup call next time. What bothers me is we saw it in the Iowa State game, controversial, the Arizona State game. I'm concerned about, just the overall quality of officiating. Really right now in that there are things happening. I think they're focused so much on things like targeting and that I think that they're missing some really blatant game changing or at least drive changing, plays or incidents. And I also think they buy into narratives sometimes, and I don't like this. It's like, you know, there was a guy, and somebody pointed out on one of the message boards, there was a defensive end, I think, from the Spartans that just, you know, after every whistle, you know, he'd take a knee to somebody's chest or, you know, whatever. And you could tell that, you know, as well, you know, boys will be boys. That's the Spartans. They play rough. They're a physical team. And then, you know, and then I think it was, what's the name of one of our offensive linemen there? Anyway, one of our offensive linemen had just had it, apparently, and just, you know, shoved the guy, offsetting penalties. Right. And then it was all the talk of, well, you know, it's an uncharacteristic breakdown of discipline in Iowa's offense.
Right.
And you're like, wait a second, where are you buying into this narrative? You got this guy that's been cheap shotting you all day, and you finally swing back, and right. now
you're on discipline.
And it's crap. And I think it, you know, it wouldn't have made a difference. I don't want to be one of those people hanging the loss on the refs.
Right.
It would not have made a difference. But I do think that officiating has become a problem this season. Just in a few high-profile cases.
I was watching one of the shows on ESPN. I forget if it was Pardon the Interruption or one of those. And I mean, three of the guys came right out and said that they believe that the Texas-Iowa State thing is basically a conspiracy, that you got to protect your bell cow money program, and they can't afford to lose to a lowly Iowa State. And God knows I'm not one to usually cry for Iowa State, because I'm one of those believers in that, you know, the state of Iowa is only big enough for one good football program. But, I mean, they got hosed. They got completely hosed.
They got hosed at home.
Yeah.
And we got hosed at home.
Yeah.
And it was weird and a little frustrating. Yeah. So
I'm with you on that.
It is a little maddening in an era where we not only have instant replay, but we use it for just about everything, that there are still things like no calls that are so blatantly, I mean, you know, we sit on the 5-yard line, and this is happening over on the other 40, you know, so,
right.
You know, I'm 90 yards away and on the other hash mark, and I can see the guy, you know, whenever somebody pulls a jersey up and you see somebody's, you know, tummy or back, they're probably being held.
That's probably hold.
When you generally see somebody, you know, tackle a defender, that's probably, you know, anyway. And then the elephant in the room, the fake punt.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. It fooled me, we can't get fooled again.
We got fooled again.
It's almost comical. If it wasn't happening to our team, it would be comical. And then, you know, Ferentz in his press conference today, stating, and I get that it was tongue-in-cheek and he wasn't serious, but, you know, he said, well, I'm to the point where we're just not even going to try to return a punt anymore. We're just
going
to fair catch everything. But so
you're not good at it,
every
coach.
Other team in America can somehow, you know, catch punts, run with punts, and not get burned repeatedly on fake punts.
Here's the weird thing is that Northwestern stopped it. I'm going back to that game again. Northwestern stopped a fake punt.
Yeah.
And I think that was like 4th and 4.
Right.
We got burned on 4th and 8.
And where?
And he got 40 or 20. He was on the 40, went to the 40.
Everybody was like turning around and running the other direction.
There was nobody around. I mean, that guy. Oh.
So there's obviously something glaringly obvious on tape. I mean, glaringly obvious on tape.
And didn't we get a new special teams guy?
Yeah.
So the problem is what? It's not the players, because it's been going on too long.
Yeah.
The people that this trend started with are graduated. So what is the problem?
You know, the theory that I've seen, and that I think we actually said last year, is that, you know, the Ferentz Godly Book of Football or whatever, and that I think he lacks the ability to comprehend that if he wouldn't do it, then somebody else might do it. I mean, I think it goes against his sensibilities.
It does.
Or
he's like, you're not playing football properly.
Right.
Punting is, you know, sacrosanct.
Right.
You don't question the punt. You don't defile it with a fake.
Exactly.
Why would you fake something holy and sacred like a punt?
Exactly.
It's maddening. You know, I think he's trying to set up a return. I get that.
Right. Mention that it was the play that they had on, the return play they had on, was the one that sprung the two big returns in the Minnesota game. And given Iowa's difficulty in moving the ball, you can see why they did that. you know, to, they needed to try to make something happen. So the idea was, we're going to try to get a big teams play here.
D'Antonio trolled us, and Ferentz took
the maybe beat. Try a blocking the punt. Yeah. At least you got everybody running at the ball.
Exactly.
So, you know, I'd be fine with 10 guys running after the ball and one guy back there to fair catch from now on.
Let's do that.
Just run after the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And if they you get know, a kickoff,
maybe he'll get a kick catch interference.
Yeah,
15-yard penalty. And I bet you if you get enough of those, your punt average.
Yeah, so either fair catch or get hit by the guys.
Exactly.
That's my solution.
I am completely on board with that because what we're doing is crap. Right. And it happened at the change of quarters. But here's the thing that I think...
When I wasn't there, but I heard that that really took the wind out of the sails of the crowd and everything.
Oh, everything. Because up until that point, we were getting the ball back. And it wasn't going to be great field position. I mean, I think they were punting from about the 40. Their 40. So it wasn't going to be great, you know, but with a decent return, maybe we could have been in the 20.
And did Iowa have a lead at that
point? No. They were up. It was a one-score game.
Okay.
It was a one-possession game. I think they were up by 6.
See, I think I turned my radio on right after the fake punt.
And
Gary Duffin did sound depressed.
And you feel like, you know, you get a punt, you get it. I think this is probably what Ferentz was thinking. You get that. You know, you fair catch it or you run it back a little bit and you get a nice little sustained drive like we had at the end of the second half. You can either tie it or take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going in the fourth quarter and it's a brand new ball game.
Yeah, it's anybody's game at that
point. Right. Instead, you give up a fake punt. Now they're inside. Now the defense stood tall and they only got a field goal out of it. But now it's a two-possession game.
Right.
They burned up another, I don't know, three minutes. And... You know, it's
just, a momentum sucker.
It's just maddening. It's maddening. Right. And everybody in the audience, everybody in the crowd is like...
Again.
What? And my brother even said, who comes to, you know, he comes to one game a year, right?
Yeah.
Turns to me right before, he's like, hey, Iowa gets burned by a lot of fake punts, right? And I'm like, I was like, well, yeah, but not from there. Come on.
Well, see, it's you're
fourth and
like
nine at 40, from their 40. I'm not from there. But, you know, look at it from D'Antonio. Why not? Your defense has been shutting the door
exactly.
Every single time. Why not take a chance?
Yeah.
Because it was the nail in the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
He was right.
Mm-hmm.
So, going with your theory, try to focus on not so much on Iowa missing their seventh fake punt in a row.
Well, it was funny is that, you know, I had you and Greg Rothbart and Ryan... I had like 4 people all texting me, and it was just constant stream of doom and gloom, and this is awful, and this team's terrible. And I'm watching, I'm like, well, they're not good, but I mean, it wasn't like the Penn State game last year.
No,
where, I mean, literally everything with bad, awful, horrible. I mean, there might as well not Iowa might as well not even shown up to that game.
Right.
So I'm looking at it, kind of going. Now they're getting beat by a team that's clearly better and is exploiting their weaknesses. And I am unhappy as a fan, but I'm not hair on fire, I guess. So that's just, but I think part of it was how I was consuming the game as well, which is,
if
know,
you were there
here, a bit here, a little on the radio there, a little on TV here. So yeah, I get that.
Yeah. And didn't you miss one of the games last year too, that was just maddening, like Iowa State?
Well, I watched it, though, in a bar in
Colorado.
Well,
I'm just saying.
No, that was bad because we were with – it was one of these bars that has, like, 6 different games on, and there's, like, affiliations from all those.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, and we were, like, being mocked by some people that were, like, Purdue fans or something like that,
oh,
of all things.
Well,
you know.
Yeah. They have bragging rights. So.
Well, we need to flush this one and flush the punt problems with it.
Is that the problem? We didn't flush the punts?
Maybe we didn't.
All right, so we're going to double flush this one.
Double flush it.
One flush for the cape, one flush for the pot.
Okay.
All right, so...
I have a bold prediction.
All right, let's hear it.
Iowa goes undefeated this weekend.
See, I saw another bold prediction, which was, I think it was coming out of Vegas, that the bye week converts a fake punt and an onside kick against Iowa during practice.
That could happen.
I would take that. What's the over on that?
What are you going to do for the bye week?
You know, I don't know. I love bye weeks in this way.
You know what we should do is go fishing. Or
I'm actually going fishing Saturday, so you're more than welcome. I'm actually going fishing and then putting the boat in for the year. So if you'd like to come, you can.
Oh, I gotta get that.
But you know what's funny about that is that one thing about Iowa losing, this will be an interesting conversation. I have such a weird love hate thing with football because when Iowa loses, now I don't care as much about the other games and what else is going on. I mean, I still will, and it'll come back a little bit more, but like, I'm not looking forward to watching football next Saturday and seeing how other teams do, because it's kind of like, we're kind of out of the conversation for now, heading back towards irrelevancy, you know, and that's one reason why on a event basis, football is the best, but for a season, I like basketball season better, because you have so many more opportunities to, you know,
I'm just not there with you. I mean, I get the appeal, but I mean, to me, when football is going well, when everything is going right with football, there's just no, you know, I mean, and it was. I mean, think of where we were this time last week. I mean, it's like, oh, I got to record Big Ten Network. They might talk about the Iowa.
Exactly.
You know, it's just, and really had this feeling that, you know, wow, if we could have pulled this one out, we would really be, you know, I mean, you know, button it up. The turnaround is, you know, is here. But now it feels like, well, the turnaround might be another year away.
Off in the distance. Which I think we all knew in the back of our heads was a possibility, but I think we were kind of seduced by the dominant nature of
what
the
do you think of, last week. There's been a lot of discussion on the message boards about, you know, because, okay, so I want to talk about something without wading into it. I don't know if that's possible to get into something controversial with at arm's length. But, you know, the last couple of weeks, there have been a lot of antagonistic threads of, hey, where are all these people who doubted the coaching staff? Come on out and take your medicine and eat your crow or something like that, because we had, you know, we were on a 4-game winning streak, we'd beaten Wisconsin, or I'm sorry, Minnesota and Iowa State, you know, and everything. And it just, it's kind of goes back to what Ferentz is fond of saying, which is you're never as good as your last win. You're never as bad as your last loss. I think that you and I have always had said that our concerns about the program and the coaching staff are always these sort of recurring anti-patterns that never seem to get better. Clock management, fake punts, onside kicks, you know.
The fake punts thing, though, is actually a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, in the first half of the Ferentz tenure, we were the team getting all the big special teams plays on other people. So that is just bizarre. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. And I'm sure the coach doesn't know either. Otherwise, he would have fixed it or done something. And we've had that conversation too. So, but to your point, I think that if you're talking about two camps or two sides of something, I think that neither of them has proper perspective. People want to, and this is in our sports culture in general, and you see this with NFL teams too, is that you want to make all these huge rushes to judgment immediately based on one weekend's results. I mean, remember at the beginning of this year when Chip Kelly, his Philadelphia Eagles, came out and just lit up whoever they played in their first game, Washington. Mm-hmm. It was like, well, look out, NFL! The Oregon Duck style of offense is here, and what is going to happen? It's a genius move. Blah, blah, blah. Well, now they're not that great. So, you know, you can't make – football is not a kind of sport where you can make grandiose judgments based on one weekend's worth of results.
Football is not deterministic.
No. And that's why I'm saying let the season unfold. I don't have a lot of confidence that Iowa's going to beat Ohio State. In fact, I would say – in my whole lifetime, Iowa doesn't beat Ohio State mostly, let alone when they have a bad team, let alone in Columbus.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm going to watch it, you know? I still think there's two wins out there.
You do?
Okay. I do.
All right.
That, so is that awesome, a 6-6 season? No, but hey.
Who do you think
beats 4-8?
Beats 4-8. What are you thinking about the rest of our division, and what do you think of over in the, I guess it's leaders. Hey, guess what? Next year we don't have to remember those stupid names
anymore. Yeah, I know. Well, how about Indiana just completely pounding Penn State?
Where did that come from?
Well, Penn State is another team that is not very deep at all. Mm-hmm. And we know that Indiana can turn that offense on at will at times, too.
Well, Northwestern could still win our division.
Sure.
They lost to Ohio State, but they could still, you know, and I guess Nebraska is finally sort of figured out, well, it still has defensive issues, but it's at least figured out how to pound Illinois, which isn't...
Well, and you mentioned, you know, Northwestern is really good at what they do, but they're not, you know, the challenge they'll pose Iowa is not the same that Michigan State posed Iowa. They're not going to overwhelm us with a suffocating defense that's an impenetrable wall of awesome.
No.
No. Their quarterback might throw for 500 yards.
Now, they got to come to Kinnick, right?
But, yeah.
See, I'm going to have to be, like, in the same 100 yards with that son of a bitch.
You're not a big Pat Fitzgerald.
Yes, yeah, Pat Fitzgerald.
I know.
He's getting fat, too. You notice this? I laugh. I said, Pat Fitzgerald. He's going to be, like, fat Fitzgerald.
No, not as fat as Bielema, though. I don't know what the boy's eating down in Arkansas.
Well, it's that southern food.
Oh, my God.
They eat barbecued Razorbacks.
He's a behemoth.
Yeah.
But anyway, what do I think of the rest of the division?
Who's got the inside track?
If Akron and UConn can almost beat Michigan, Iowa can beat Michigan.
Yeah.
How a team is performing on a given weekend is going to make a difference in what the matchups are.
Well, we'll see. I think the important thing is win or lose at Ohio State, and I think we're both saying lose. What I think we want to see is improvement. We want to see a bounce back. We don't want to see him just hang it up.
Yeah.
Because the Northwestern game is definitely winnable.
When I still maintain, had the injuries from the Penn State game last year not been as devastating as they were on the offensive line particularly, I think another win or two would have probably ensued. I mean, a few of those games were still close last year. The Indiana game was close. The Northwestern game was relatively close. The Nebraska game was close.
Purdue. Yeah.
Well, last week during the bye week, we invited our friend and local beer enthusiast, Kurt Allmeyer, to participate in bye week beer week. We're a week out from the bye week, but we decided to have Kurt come back in anyway to talk to us about beer because
we all like beer.
We always like to talk about beer.
It's never wrong to talk about beer.
No. So I think we kind of went over a lot of the basics last year about beer and probably bored quite a few people, but that's okay. But what we'd like to talk about, I think, this year is a little bit about maybe some new things that are out there, trends, good beers you've had. So what's new in your personal world of beer and in the beer world in general, Kurt?
Well, I've been trying to get away from IPAs, which everybody seems to drink, but it's a slippery slope to get away from that. So I've had some sours lately.
Wait a minute. What do you mean slippery slope to get away? I mean, like you can't escape the IPAs? They're just everywhere? Or?
Well, that's part of it, is they're so prevalent that, you know, there's plenty of those around trying to find sours. And I like bitter beers, so it's always an easy go-to for me.
Describe the sours. What's that style about?
Sours they can be sour, they can be tart. They tend to have kind of a wine type of component to them almost, because they're aged and fermented a little bit differently with some different types of yeast and often barrel aged.
I had a delicious Flemish sour this past week. I was in Philadelphia on business and went to a place called Monk's Cafe, which I recommend to anybody. It's allegedly one of the top five beer bars in the world, the entire globe. And they actually have this beer contract brewed for them by a monastery, I guess, or a brewery in Belgium. And it was really good, but they told me that it had a balsamic aftertaste. So it was kind of like beer that you could put on salad. So that was a little unusual.
You can find that beer on bottles occasionally. And I think that's one of the first types of sours I had. And that one does kind of take you by surprise because you can find some that have a nice fruity component with some tartness to them. And then there's ones that are like that can be a little bit off-putting because of the vinegariness.
Now, so this is different than the lambics, right?
It's kind of along those lines, though.
Okay, because I went to a lambic brewery in Brussels, and some of that stuff was just foul. I'll just say. I mean, I know it's been around for 500 years or whatever, but some of that stuff was really tough to taste.
Well, and, you know, they tend to use more wild yeast, and who knows where that's coming from and what it tastes like. You know, you read about beers that is made from, you know, with bacteria taken from monks' beards or scraped from the bottoms of their feet, and it's like,
well, you know, the story is that they remodeled or renovated this like 600-year-old building, and the yeast was living in the rafters,
right,
in the wood, and so they just basically exposed the wart, is it?
The wart? Yeah.
Yeah. They just expose it to the air in this particular room that they built, you know, just for that. And then it just catches the yeast that's growing. And they can't use any, like, chemicals to clean the place. So it's awful.
Well, and that's what they'll call, like, open fermentation, because they'll just have an open container, which, you know, hey, whatever hops in kind of thing. So
now when you talk about beers that kind of veer away from the IPA crowd, and I'm kind of with you, Kurt. I enjoy a good IPA, but as I've said before, it's sort of another IPA in a sea of IPAs anymore.
Right.
I've been kind of getting into some of these mashup type beers. One of my favorites that I would recommend if anybody ever gets up to Wisconsin is one called Bedlam from Ale Asylum in Madison. And that's sort of a Belgian mix with an IPA that I think is just a fabulous beer.
And you start to, that style kind of caught fire a little while ago. But it seems to have faded fairly quickly, though, where it has that kind of Belgian bite to it with the yeast and with the Brettanomyces yeast, and then with the hops as well. Green Flash made a really good one. Raging Bitch makes a pretty good one, too, that you can find, you know, around here. I haven't seen the Green Flash one in a while.
And then, Tori, when you were over for the Minnesota game, I think I gave you one of those Omegang BPAs, a Belgian Pale Ale, which I really like that one.
Yeah, that was a good one, too. That was a good one. So,
is that similar to the Bedlam?
It was similar. I think it was maybe a little darker.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I like, and I've been getting into some of the porters.
Sure.
You know, and then I know, Tori, you have developed a bit of a taste for milk stouts as well. So I think, yeah, I think people are starting to maybe, or at least in our circle of friends, but, you know, some of the articles I'm reading as well, people are starting to move beyond IPAs because, like you said, Tori, it's just, there are good ones out there, but there's just, everybody's got an IPA, and some microbrews seem to have like five or six different IPAs or double IPAs or, you know, special release IPAs or, you know, it just gets a little tiring to keep up with it all.
Well, I know recently I sent an article to Kurt that was talking about sort of overdoing the IPAs, how it can kind of wreck your sense. You have to keep going more and more bitter because it kind of is, you know, wearing down your taste buds eventually. And of course there's, who is it that makes the one called Palate Wrecker, Kurt?
That's Green Flash.
That's Green Flash as well. But I'm trying to remember what the phrase they had in that article for it. I think it was IPA fatigue.
Yeah, you do have to kind of reset your taste buds every once in a while. Because, you know, those really extreme IPAs can really, you know, take a toll on them.
Right.
And that's why I drink scotch.
Yeah, and then pretty soon that's all you can taste. And then that's all you judge a good beer to be. And I think, I remember that article, Tori. I think you sent it to Kurt. I think I may have sent it to you because I got it from somebody I worked with, which was this guy had was a microbrew that had like his I think his like brown ale or something was like world class brown ale or something, you know, in its category, but couldn't even crack like the top 10 in, you know, in an overall category because it was all IPAs.
You got to be that guy though, don't you? Got to be like that. Well, I heard that band before they were cool.
Well, you know,
and you know, you run across these craft breweries that make a pilsner, you know, kind of as a way to do something different from an IPA, and you know, people just kind of turn up their nose at them, but they can be really good and they're crisp and have just enough hops to, you know, keep you interested with them.
Well, that's another beer plug I'll throw in then. If you, again, Wisconsin Brewery New Glarus makes a Pilsner called Edelpils, which they hadn't made for quite a few years and then brought back. And wow, it's just so crisp and refreshing and perfect balance of like malt and just a tiny bit of hops. But man, that's a good, did I give you one of those, Kurt?
Yeah, I think I had one of those. That was a good beer.
So any, you know, last time I think you took us to Beer Fest, and then I think, was it December when the world was supposed to end with that Mayan calendar?
Yeah.
Or whatever, we went to, there was something going on over at Ribco. What was that called?
It was one of their special release events.
Right. Anything, anything like that? Any events on the calendar we should know about?
There is one later this month, and I can't remember if it's next Wednesday or the following Wednesday. I think it's 2 weeks from tomorrow. At Ribco, it's all pumpkin ales, and they're going to serve them, I do believe, in pumpkins.
So that's it brings up a good point, is that there seem to be, you know, some of my favorite beers are seasonal. What are we expecting, I think, you know, as we move into fall, and, you know, I think a lot of folks are bringing out their, you know, whatever you call it, their Oktoberfest or something like that, or moving into pumpkin ales or other spiced ales. But what else, you know, usually comes out in the fall or even in the winter?
Well, I think this year, Oktoberfest style beers were released really early, like end of July, early August.
Yeah, I don't like that. I mean, it's still 85 freaking degrees out. Yeah, I mean, part of the beauty of an Oktoberfest beer is like being outside around a campfire or, you know, tailgating in a crisp, cool day and drinking it. That's when it tastes the best. I don't get that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not a style that's really made for warm weather with the kind of malty. And I mean, it's not a super strong beer usually, but, you know, it's not one that's cool and refreshing, or light and refreshing, I should say. But, you know, you're going to start seeing more seasonal stouts, imperial stouts at this point. Barley wines are around the corner. You know, barrel aged stuff will start popping up. Actually, pretty soon you start seeing some harvest type ales, IPAs that are fresh hopped because of the hop harvest.
Can you get those here?
Yeah, I'm thinking Founders Harvest Ale should show up in the next week or two. That's a usually pretty good one.
So is our friend Dustin going to make his own fresh hopped ale now that he has all those hops growing along his fence?
I haven't asked him about that to see when they're going to do anything. I have to look into that.
Yeah, exactly. It's his hop. That's what his grow operation is, right?
Yeah. So for a local plug, Kurt, did you have a chance to try Great River Breweries? I think they had some kind of a spiced ale or something that they just tapped not too long ago.
I think they did a pumpkin. They're releasing something this weekend. I think their Big Cock IPA is this weekend.
That's a good beer.
They do an Oktoberfest, and then I think they did a pumpkin ale. I didn't try the pumpkin ale. I'm not a fan of that style. I'm not a fan of pumpkin beers.
Well, Jim, you remember our friend Lance that used to be, you know, real tall Lance into punk rock, blah, blah, blah. So I was in Philly, and he lives there now, and his girlfriend owns a bar. And they were actually doing a pumpkin ale night, and I'm not usually a big fan of that one either, but I will put in a plug for Southern Tears. Southern Tier has a really good pumpkin ale, and I think, you know, we can get the Southern Tier beers here in Iowa, I think.
Like at Hy-Vee?
I think so. I don't know that I've seen the specific pumpkin ale one, but if anybody's out there and sees one, it's one of the few pumpkin ales that I really enjoyed.
So Southern Tears, I think, is called Pumpking.
Yes, Pumpking.
And they also do a pumpkin stout, apparently, called Warlock, that I've heard good things about.
Have to keep an eye out for that one.
Oh, you guys are making me thirsty, and I can't have a beer for at least a couple of hours yet.
I know, I have to go back to work, so I'll be able to partake either for a while.
Like that's ever stopped you before?
Well,
so I hear that that any other news on just the, you know, the craft beer industry or anything like that? I mean, I know that there have been some discussions that here locally, I think. And I live in LeClaire, and I think that we're going to see, was it Great River, Tori?
Great River is partnering with the Mississippi Distillery.
Yeah.
Because one of the reasons is the distillery, because of Iowa law, can't actually serve their alcohol on premise. So Great River's partnering with them, and they're going to open a brewery and bar where they'll also be able to serve their alcohol. And I think it'll be a nice partnership, because they've used Great River's barrels, I think, to do some of their barrel age stuff before. So it should be interesting.
Yeah, and then I would look forward to having something like that locally. The only catch is I haven't heard anything about location, where it's going to be, or if they've even found a spot yet. For that.
I thought it was going to be right next door.
Yeah, that's what I understood, too.
Oh, okay, great. Well, maybe they already have that.
Because there is space right there, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah, I think they're building on, like, an addition. Like, they're building new.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's one thing. I mean, any other things that you're aware of that are coming locally?
Here's a question that I have. Is, at some point, don't we reach a saturation point? I mean, of how much craft beer can there be? I mean, I know it's taking market share still from the macro beers, but I mean, there's so many of them. At some point, it's going to be hard for people to make money doing it. I mean, it's a passion, I get that, but I mean, geez.
Well, I talked to the brewer at Front Street when they opened their Freight House tasting room, and he seemed to think that the Quad Cities could handle more breweries than it has now. I mean, obviously not on a huge scale, but
yeah, and I think, Tori, to your point, I mean, we noticed in Wisconsin that every local bar has the local brew, you know, and so maybe it just becomes more of a fractured market as opposed to any one, you know, one offering becoming dominant. And I think, you know, back to like traveling in Europe where the different towns would have their local beer as well, and maybe that's what we're, maybe that's the end game for all of this diversification. But I think, you know, I think the cream will rise to the top, and the, you know, the good beers. I think there's some still some artificial barriers to distribution that probably need to start going away. It's funny when you go to other parts of the country and you ask them, you know, what their ungettable beers are, and it's the ones that, you know, we get here. It's like Founders and Bell's and you know, stuff like that that's here in the Midwest. And then you also read where the big breweries like InBev and Anheuser-Busch and whatever are putting pressure on the retail outlets like grocery stores and liquor stores to carry fewer and fewer of those craft beers and to stock more of the, you know, I guess what we would have typically called just the regular run-of-the-mill stuff. So I think there's just that's the part that worries me, is more than oversaturation, it's just this kind of artificial scarcity.
Well, have you noticed the advertising marketing that a lot of these macro breweries are doing now to try to kind of fool consumers into thinking what they're purchasing is a craft beer? You know, I'm thinking of like Blue Moon, which, you know, and I don't hate Blue Moon. I mean, it serves its purpose, but you know, and some of these others, I think even Budweiser, like regular Budweiser the other day, they were kind of showing the guys like tasting it and whatnot.
Yeah. And Shock Top.
Shock Top is one of those. That's an Anheuser-Busch one.
Yeah.
You know, even Miller has, you know, I think they're kind of angling Leinenkugel's towards that, actually.
Well, Leinenkugel's did start as kind of a regional craft brewery, because I mean, I remember getting it when it in Wisconsin, when that was about the only place you could get it. You know, they brewed it up in Chippewa Falls, and then it got bought out, and so they're sort of rebranding it as a...
But how many flavors of Summer Shandy have you seen in the last 6 months?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and as some of these craft beers, you know, grow up, you know, and become larger, then they start to look, or they start to at least become nationwide. You know, I think you could probably say that Sam Adams and Sierra Nevada and... you know, maybe New Belgium and Goose Island are approaching that level where are they really craft anymore? They're certainly not micro when you can get them pretty much anywhere in the U.S.
Right. I like your thought though about cream rising to the top. I mean, at the end of the day, the consumer is the one that benefits by there being so many beers to choose from. I mean, that's one of my favorite things to do when I travel now. That's the first thing I ask when I go to a bar. Hey, what do you got that's good and local? You know, I had a couple, this McGillen's, pale ale when I was in Philadelphia. It was really quite tasty.
Yeah, that's always a fun thing to do, and I think there's some apps and some websites that can help guide you, you know, to whatever local beer there is, either at a liquor store, they get, you know, they can point you to liquor stores that have good selections, or to bars that have good things on tap. I go out to Arizona quite a bit, and there's something called a Kilt Lifter that's out there. It's a Scotch ale. It's actually pretty good, and it's fairly strong. I think that's the one thing that always sneaks up on me, because it tastes just like a regular Scotch ale, but it sneaks up on you a little bit. So
Kurt, what sort of things do you use to try to find good beer if you're out on the road or traveling somewhere?
You know, Beer Advocate's a good resource. You know, it can point you towards bars, liquor stores. You know, in their forum sections, it will tell you what's being released. You know, there's usually discussions about coming releases, you know, what people have heard as far as releases. So that's the one that I usually kind of stick with. And, you know, locally I use Beer Menus. .com, which has, you know, and it's interesting the number of bars and restaurants that have been added to that over the last few months, because you know, I'll check a couple of, you know, I'll check their website to see if there's, if I want to go get a beer, well, should I go here or should I go here, you know, depending on what they might have on draft or, you know, some type of new bottle they might have.
And I will put another plug in for the Untappd app. That's Untappd with no E. That's a fun way on your smartphone to kind of keep a running, I guess, journal of the different beers you have. You can do pictures, you rate them, you can write notes, and you can also, you know, see what other people around you are drinking as well. So that's a good one as well.
Well, now here's the thing. I don't think I'm using that app properly, because I don't check in on every beer, just the ones that are new.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's generally what I do. I mean, if I'm going to, like, you know, have a lawnmower beer and just like knock down a Miller High Life or something, I'm not going to enter it into Untappd. I mean, you don't want to look like an alcoholic.
You know, and I'm kind of the same way. You know, depending on if I haven't had something in a while, I might check it in again. You know, if I'm finding it on draft as opposed to in bottles, I might put something on there and add a comment on, you know, how it is compared to maybe what I've had before, bottle or draft. So, you know, but you know, I'm not certainly entering every Miller Lite or, you know, something like that that I'm drinking. Not that I'm drinking that stuff.
Of course not. We would never admit that publicly, right?
Well, you know, that's one thing, though, is that, I admit, I don't think I am exactly a beer snob, because I'll enjoy, like, you know, sometimes when I'm camping or something, like, I like just regular plain Coors, not the Coors Light, the Coors Banquet beer or whatever. I still like a regular Leinenkugel's once in a while. So, you know, I think there is a place for your just even your macro brews. You know, I like Coors Light when I tailgate, because it's like usually 7 o'clock in the morning and I don't want to have a 9% ABV beer, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm just kind of messing with Kurt a little bit here.
Whenever I stop at my folks' house, I drink whatever beer's in the refrigerator.
Exactly.
Well, luckily, I've got them kind of trained, but it's not always a perfect world.
Which goes back to the main point, which is the best beer in the world is a free beer.
I do not argue with that.
All right, well, we appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your wisdom with us, Kurt.
I don't know if there was a lot of wisdom in that, but it was nice chatting about beer always.
It's always good to chat about beer, and make sure you keep us in mind if you hear about anything new or if you know of any events coming up, but I might skip the pumpkin ale thing.
I'm going to go crack one open right now.
Oh, right. Jealous.
All right, well, get to work. I know that as a esteemed reporter, you've got a lot of city council news going on tonight, city politics. So we'll let you go for that, but thanks again, and hopefully see you next year during Beer Week.
All right, go Hawks!
Oh, it's always good talking to Kurt.
Absolutely.
You know, he took us to that, well, what was it, that festival where... Festive Ale, yeah, where you got the tickets.
Yeah.
That was good. Yeah. Did they already do that this year?
No, the guy cheapskated out of it, and so he didn't hold it this year.
Oh,
it was very disappointing.
That was really cool.
I don't know.
There were probably, 30 or 40 different microbrews there, and they give you those little glasses, and you walk around. That was really, really amazing. You're sitting there writing it all down or capturing it in your apps, right. You know, trying to write down all the names of these beers. But
that was the day I got the Take It Easy app because it said you've now had like 12 beers in 4 hours. Like, well, they were tiny little
oh, is that your
tasting things. Yeah,
untapped, thought you were app. Guzzling bombers exactly. Or something.
You might want to take it easy, oh, right? Yeah. Yeah. I had a ride.
I wonder if there's like a lawyer over at that company saying, you know, when you put a competitive game around the consumption of alcohol, you might want to have some boundaries.
That's probably true. So, a little bit of news. I got bought season basketball tickets for the first time since I was a student this
when's
year.
When's basketball season?
Here in the end of October. And I want people to know it's not because I've been off the bandwagon. It's that there's so many games and we live an hour away and it's in the winter. And my work schedule used to prohibit me from going to a lot of them because I had night meetings and things like that. But now that I have a more favorable work schedule and I'm going to see how that goes. So,
well, basketball is just a tougher investment because the games are during the week.
Right.
Sometimes they're during the day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like on Saturdays and stuff like that, or Sundays. And like you said, there's got to be three times as many.
Well, yeah. And but the nice thing about it is it's not a full day's time investment either. You can get up and back in probably 3 or 4 hours if you need
to. But we shouldn't really talk too much about basketball in particular or our expectations for the season because I feel like there's just going to be so much to talk about when it comes to basketball.
That's true. And but the question is, are we going to try to push the podcast on, maybe not weekly, but do it,
something.
You know, keep it going through
something.
The
I don't know. I don't have... you know, a whole lot to add or contribute when we talk about basketball.
Maybe that'll be the fun part. It'll be, you know, Jim's first year really paying attention to basketball.
Well, no, I pay attention. I like watching the games, but I, you know, I've told you before, I don't see the strategy or the gameplay or the play calling. What I see is people trying to out-athlete each other a lot. And
in college ball, there's more strategy, though.
Trying to get the favorable matchup.
Right.
You know, that's what I see a lot of. Well, no prediction. I predict probably nothing. No walleye. I predict a couple of, maybe some bass.
I've caught some of my biggest walleyes out of that lake.
Yeah. What was that day?
But they're random. They're just random. You never know where you're going to get them. They're hard to target.
Remember we got into that school of moon eyes?
That was, in the Mississippi.
That was weird.
Though. That was creepy.
That was really creepy because they have these really big eyes and they're fragile.
Yeah, they bleed.
They're bleeders.
Like, you think that the...
Like the royal family of fish. Exactly. Like,
there must be some sort of, genetic advantage.
There's just hemophilia.
I don't know what it could be, but...
I don't know, but it's like... We're trying really hard not to hurt these fish and throw them in. And I'm like, man, it's bleeding all over you. I don't know what that was about. And then, you know, you get another one. You're like, oh, you know, I promise this one's not a moon eye. And you pull out, it's bigger than the last one.
Exactly.
They fought pretty well, sort of. I don't know. But, yeah. But I think I need some fishing. I think I need to do some yard work, too, probably, because we got some rain. And actually, things are growing a little bit again.
Well, this podcast is starting to go nowhere fast.
It is. Talking about fishing and yard work. But we did talk about beer.
We did.
All right. Well, with that, let's wrap it up. Let's say on Iowa.
Go Hawks!